Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Before we grab our regular Friday guest from Texas, we want to remind you that we begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he testified during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I did this because I wanted his voice ringing in your ears when you voted in 2020, November. I think right now there's a cacophony in your ears given the events of the last couple of months. But the most important thing, exercise the franchise. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, it must be Texas. If it must be Texas, it must be Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, the person who has taught us more about Texas politics, and I am becoming so incredibly savvy. I am losing Texas references in every talk I give.
You don't need me anymore.
No, I totally need
you. You're solid.
So I posted on Facebook this morning the Quinnipiac poll. And the Quinnipiac poll has Trump and Biden in a dead heat. And I don't know how reliable
in
the
Texas.
Quinnipiac poll is, but if nothing else, it's an interesting poll because if nothing else, it probably has Donald Trump completely out of his mind. But what I did when I posted that was that I said, that's not really the story.
Okay.
What the story is that this really sort of creates some evidence that the Texas House of Representatives could flip in November. And if the Texas House flips in November, that changes America forever. Because it is really the year of the census. It's the year of redistricting. It has such incredible potential for a different future. I mean, it would be nice if Biden won, but I think what is even more critical is what it would mean for the state government at this crucial time.
There is no path to the presidency for a Republican without Texas, right? And you never want to read too much into one poll. I was looking at the methodology on this poll, and Arnie, polling has really just been decimated by the fact that nobody uses a landline telephone anymore. Isn't that amazing that an entire industry that we rely on to give us good information about what's going to happen in elections has not figured out how to really poll people? They haven't figured it out ever since people stopped using landlines. They have these opt-in polls online, which seems ridiculous. And looking at the methodology of this, and I'm not saying anything ugly about Quinnipiac. I mean, I think they've been a pretty reliable pollster. But when I see this, it says that they polled, quote, self-identified registered voters in Texas. What does that mean? That means people who said that they are registered to vote. They didn't even verify whether they actually are registered to vote. So just keep all that in mind. It's a grain of salt that you need to take this with. So I'm looking at the numbers. And yeah, this has not been an outlier. This poll, as far as the presidential race, a lot of polls have shown that President Trump and Vice President Biden have been in a dead heat in Texas. That's been the case. Not only is the Texas House in play, as you said, the Democrats need to win a net 9 seats the majority, which isn't that much. Republicans have made it clear that they're not just going to play defense. They're going to play offense as well. Just last week, a national Republican group headed up in part by former Speaker of the House, Joe Strauss, who was, of course, always criticized as being too liberal, and Karl Rove, also on the board of the group, saying they're going to target 6 Texas House members who are freshman Democrats Those Democrats who won their seats in 2018 in districts that President Trump carried in 2016 when he was elected, when he won Texas by 9 points. And the Democrats, through Eric Holder's group, you may have seen he has that redistricting focused group. They right. said they were endorsing about 30 Democratic candidates for the Texas House, which is, you know, casting quite a wide net. I don't think they can get anywhere close to that. But it does signal, and look, Holder is an ally of former President Obama, of course. He was his attorney general, said to be his wingman and all that. I think it does signal to other Democratic groups which places
they want to focus.
They need to put their money and put their resources such that they could possibly have a positive result. If you look at this poll from Quinnipiac, one of the things I found fascinating is the fact that Senator Cornyn, his numbers just don't move. And Cornyn and Trump will lead the ticket in Texas. The way the ticket looks, the way the ballot looks is president, then U.S. Senator, right? And Cornyn is at 37% job approval in Texas, 36% disapproval. What's fascinating, Arnie, that hasn't moved much at all over the last couple of years. Senator Cornyn has been sort of languishing in his approval in Texas when you might think that he might be higher. And especially since we're in an election year, that he's starting to, he hasn't really ramped up yet. It's still early before November, I should say that. But, you know, you would think that he'd want to start really burnishing his image here and trying to get out there and, really make a big general election push, particularly when everything is so volatile. You remember that during the last legislative session, we talked a lot about this, the idea that there will now be no one-punch straight ticket voting in Texas anymore. Right. You can't just hit the button for Democrats or Republicans. We're one of only a few states where that was even the case anymore. But the legislature, in all their wisdom, chose to do away with that, to completely change the way in which you exercise the franchise in Texas, which is you have to go in to each individual race and make your selection. You could vote for President Trump, and if you wanted to, you could vote for the Democrat who's running for U.S. Senate. You could vote for all other Republicans if that's what you wanted to do. But you don't have the option of just saying, I'm a Republican and vote that way, or I'm a Democrat and vote that way, right? So on this question of why they did that, it was so that the statewide candidates and the state house candidates and others could divorce themselves from national politics if that's what they chose to do. They could run their campaigns. They could run their campaigns independent of what's going on with the president. But Senator Cornyn's not doing that. I mean, you may have seen him on Fox News Channel just this week saying that the protests around the country have got to be put down, that that we can't tolerate this, that he's basically taking the same line as President Trump and praising President Trump when he doesn't necessarily have to do that. But here's the thing, the reality, Arnie, is even though they wrote it into the law, it changed the way that we vote. President Trump and his quote unquote leadership style really leaves people no place to hide. There's no nuance, right? I mean, you're either with Trump or you're not. Basically, they tried to untie their hands, uncuff themselves from national politics. They can't get away from it. Everything is more and more nationalized, no matter how they want to run their campaigns.
So a couple of things I'm thinking about. You're absolutely right. I understand the theory when they decided to get rid of straight ticket voting, because it is not uncommon in my state as well for a lot of candidates who want to run as independent contractors. They don't want to associate right. with the party. So they sort of carve out, they don't put R or D next to their name.
Right.
They just put their name out there. So as if somehow it's the aura of perfection or whatever. I think you're absolutely right. And I think that the agenda right now, Donald Trump has demanded allegiance. He has basically castrated Republicans so they can't even speak out against him, because that will not work with their base. And what does he have? 80 to 87%, 90% approval within the Republican base of the party?
Absolutely.
So that gives, that's ahistoric, everyone. Mm-hmm. That has never happened. You might have had 70% approval. You might have had 67% approval. But these are numbers that are atmospheric. But the other problem is, it's also a shrinking Republican Party, an aging Republican Party, a white That's Republican right. Party. And so as we look at Texas, what we know about Texas is it really is the face of the future of America. It is a browning of America. It's a more youthful America. And I think as a result, Cornyn has a really tough time. But here's my question for you.
Yeah.
Have you seen what the new ballot will look like in 2020? So I know you can't straight ticket anymore, but will it always be Republicans are first, Democrats are second, or will it be mixed up? Do you have any idea what the ballot will look like under president so that people can start practicing. I'm being serious here, but can start practicing to find the candidates that they want to associate with?
It's an interesting question. I mean, in Texas, it's that the Republican's always on one side and the Democrat is on the other side. And then if you have any independent or Green Party or Libertarian or whatever, that's underneath the underneath the other two. We'll take a look at that, Arnie. Of course, we have a primary runoff that is still yet to come here in July, July 14th in Texas. And then we move on to the general election. And of course, in the meantime, we also have the threat of the coronavirus and the question about whether people are going to be voting by mail. I should give you an update on that. By the way, we have seen the courts go back and forth about whether or not people should be able to vote by mail in Texas, whether there should be expansion of mail ballots. The Texas Supreme Court said in their ruling a week ago that they don't agree with Democrats and others who say that lack of immunity to COVID-19 is a physical condition that should allow you to be able to get a mail-in ballot in Texas. But one of the major counties, the biggest county by population in Texas, Harris County, where Houston is, has interpreted the rest of the ruling to mean that they can go ahead and issue mail ballots to basically anybody who requests them. And as I looked at the ruling, Arnie, the justices were really kind of leaving it up to the elections administrators in every county to figure that out. One of the things that folks should keep in mind about it is that there would really be no way for the Texas Attorney General or for anybody else really to police what the elections administrators in 254 counties, what all of them are going to do. If there's a little old lady in East Texas who is 60 or 64 instead of 65, because 65 and up, you can get a mail-in ballot no matter what. Right. But if somebody's 64 and they ask for a mail-in ballot, is the elections administrator in Smith County, I'll just make it up, Smith County is where Tyler, Texas is, are they really going to say, no, you can't have one? No, they're probably
Let me follow up on your comment, though. So you said that Harris County has interpreted the decision of the Texas Supreme Court as allowing people to sort of request mail-in ballots if they have the fear of contracting COVID. Have they announced that publicly? Have they put that into the regs for election officials so that because it's so early, we're talking June, sweetheart, that someone could challenge the decision and the interpretation of the Harris County officials to the Texas Supreme Court so Texas Supreme Court can then slap it down?
We'll see. It was in the Houston Chronicle. It was reported there a couple of days ago that that's the way they're interpreting this. This has already been to the Texas Supreme Court. I don't expect it to go back before the election. I think that the justices tried to walk a fine line here. And as one veteran observer of Texas politics pointed out the other day, when the Texas Supreme Court, which of course is elected, the justices are statewide positions, they're all Republican at this point in a Republican state. As somebody said the other day, somebody who's been watching this stuff for about 45 years, they said they could not remember any case previously that had gone before the Texas Supreme Court where they were ruling on a matter that would directly impact their own elections like this, because there are several justices who are up for re-election this year. And I've seen some independent polling, Arnie, that shows, and who you would have to put money behind this and let people know that it was the case, but we don't have straight ticket voting anymore, as we mentioned. There are quite a few Republicans who could be convinced to vote for a Democrat for Texas Supreme Court if they knew that the reason they were having to go vote in person instead of vote at home is because those justices voted to make them go to the polling place.
So, and what would be great is you already, and what would it would hurt is the demographic that I think is such, is really the swing demographic. You probably know older voters tend to vote more Republican.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But from 65 to about 45, that really is a group that, you know, may more historically vote Republican. Well, but if they're worried about their health, if they have a heart condition, if they have diabetes, all of a sudden, they're going to look at the court going, you're going to put me at risk because I'm not the golden 65 and I have to worry about COVID. In a way, it's a great marketing tool to those individuals.
What's remarkable, Arnie, is the degree to which Republican leadership, including the governor, the attorney general, the lieutenant governor, and others, they have fought tooth and nail against expanding mail-in ballots. But the evidence shows from around the country, Republicans kick ass at mail-in ballots. They're very good at it. If you look, for example, in Florida, they clean up in mail-in ballots. The Republican Party in Florida has a huge mail-in ballot program, and it's usually the Democrats that have to try to catch up in early voting and on election day with their group, which just simply doesn't vote by mail. They just don't do it, but Republican voters are very good at it.
All right, so I got a couple of questions. One is, this is incredible. Lieutenant Governor Patrick defends President Trump by saying that the reason we have racism, okay, remember this, is because people have turned their backs on God and Jesus. And I'm thinking about some of those evangelicals that are supporting Donald Trump, who is clearly an overt racist. And I'm just wondering, has he been able to like explain that connection to him?
The lieutenant governor was asked on Fox News Channel about the comments by General James Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, who you have seen. It was first in the Atlantic and then reported everywhere else that Mattis had basically taken Trump to task and said that he was angry and appalled by what he was seeing. Mattis and, by the way, also the current Secretary of Defense, Esper, had come out and rebuked the president when he said he wanted to send United States military into states that the president doesn't deem have done enough to quell the protests and the riots in the aftermath of the George Floyd killing in Minnesota. When the lieutenant governor was asked about what General Mattis had said, he changed the subject to Jesus. Because of course he did. And he said that, look, this comment from, I'll do my best Dan Patrick for you. This comment from General Mattis is a distraction because what we have in this country is a huge group of people who have turned their backs on God and turned their backs on Jesus. And the reason that we don't have a solution to racism is because we don't have enough love. We need to turn to Jesus in this. And of course the liberals, the left, has tried to drive God out of the public square. He's saying this in defense of President Trump, who was asked in 2015 if he could name his favorite Bible verse, and he could not do so. You may have seen people were once again recirculating that interview when he was running for president. They asked Trump what his favorite Bible verse was, and it wasn't a trick question. They were asking because he had said it was his favorite book. In the interview, he said sometimes he would joke about, you know, holding up his book, The Art of the Deal, and say, that's my second favorite book. My first favorite book is the Bible. When they asked him, are you more of an Old Testament guy or a New Testament guy? He said, well, I would say probably about equal because they're both really good. The Bible is, it's a special thing. But he said it was personal. He didn't, you know, it's a very personal thing to get into exactly which scripture that he really reads. This is a guy who held up the Bible at the church after having the police clear the way from him, for him to be able to go over there. And the way one of my friends described it, it was like if you were in the third grade and you were holding up a book to do a book report, a book that you had not read.
So I want to continue along this theme. Ted Cruz said the protesters are the ones to blame for being shoved out of the way for Trump's photo op. So can we have a conversation about the First Amendment? I want to do a sit down with this brilliant Ted Cruz, who's
a constitutional attorney.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Republican senators were asked one after another at the Capitol what they thought about the fact that the president, and it was not in dispute. We saw some dispute about the exact details about the way the police moved the protesters out of the way so that the president could go to that church. There was some reporting about whether or not tear gas had been used. From credible reports on the ground, it was pretty clear tear gas had been used, but whether it was, you know, flashbangs, smoke bombs, you know, using the shields to move people out of the way, these were, for the most part, peaceful protesters, and I think almost exclusively peaceful protesters from everything I've seen for the reporting on the ground. The president had the police move those folks out of the way so that he could go do this photo op with the Bible at the church. And even the pastor who oversees the church said that it was, I'm paraphrasing, but said it was blasphemous. Well, Republican senators were asked about this. Some in the GOP simply refused to answer the question when TV cameras were shoved in their face, and they just moved on and didn't really answer it. Or they said, well, I didn't really see that, so I can't really comment on it, which is such a cop-out answer. Ted Cruz, the very junior senator from Texas, he's the one who said when he was asked, was it an abuse of power? And he said, yes, by the protesters and the violence.
Oh, my God. Has anyone asked any of the Republican senators about the concept of separation of church and state? Because what Donald Trump did was, by using the church as a prop, he has now taken away that idea of the separation of church and state. And he has now embraced the church as a vehicle for his political agenda. It's not just that it was a prop, but supposedly they're constantly talking about, you know, the separation of church and state, and we have to respect the church. Well, what Donald Trump did was trample on that. It wasn't just what he did with the protesters by moving them away. I mean, it was like every First Amendment idea gets completely destroyed under Donald Trump's presidency.
I think that the risk that liberals run when they talk about this, and I don't mean you, Arnie, but it's the sort of idea that faith should not inform the decisions that are made by people who are in office or shouldn't inform their philosophy in life. I mean, go all the way back to Bill Clinton and other Democrats back in the day who would give an amazing speech at a church and are people of faith, and that's okay. And I think a trap that some, quote, on the left fall into is that if you reject what Donald Trump did the other day, then that means that somehow you are disrespecting religion. And I would make the argument that he's the one.
That's my point.
Yeah, the very people who should probably be the most upset that he did that, some of those people are the ones who embrace it and say, look, a man of God, you know, finally, because all they see is the picture, Arnie. You know, it's all sort of edited out. If you look at what the president and others have pushed out about this, it's just that he was at the church, and that you also see the picture of him walking to the church from the White House, and he's sort of looking like a hero while he's doing it. But they leave out the part that he used, let's say it this way, used government force to move peaceful protesters out of the way so that he could do a photo op with a Bible. To a lot of folks, is completely blasphemous. But if all you know is that he was there holding the Bible and you're a person of faith, you would think, well, okay, well, he's on my side. Again, this guy who couldn't even tell you anything about the book, the only thing he can tell you is it's his favorite book and it is very special.
I think one of his press secretaries, made a reference to Winston Churchill, and that the reason why he was going to the church wasn't because of the photo op. He wanted to survey the damage. That's why he was going, was that he wanted to survey the damage. And then when he was asked about the bunker, it's not the onion. It's not the onion. That's the part that just so amazes me. I wrote, who writes this crap when I'm reading it? Because I'm like, this is cartoonish.
Look, in the evangelical tradition, I mean, the deal is that you can live your life as a sinner, and then you can find Jesus, and you can make amends, and you can find your way to religion. I don't think that anybody, and a lot of folks had, you know, problems with former President Bush for a variety of reasons. And by the way, I thought that his response to the George Floyd killing was very thoughtful. And he talked about, you know, the wrongs of the country and the fact that Black people have to put up with what they have to put up with. You know, he was an evangelical guy. He was somebody who was born again. And I don't think anybody doubted his faith. But when you look at the sort of carnival barking that goes on from somebody like Donald Trump or our lieutenant governor, who wrote in his own book, which I'll send you a copy, Arnie, one of them's holding up my pool table. No, it's keeping it level. No, I'm kidding. His book is called The Second Most Important Book You'll Ever Read. It's a personal challenge to read the Bible. And he talks in the book. Patrick talks about how he was at a radio station owner in Houston. He talks about how he was at a radio convention in Las Vegas, which is reopening this week. And he was there at the Tropicana Hotel, and all of a sudden he had this epiphany and he found Jesus. And outside the Tropicana Hotel, he got on his knees and he says that he prayed harder than he ever prayed before or since. And he'll tell you to this day that his life was changed, not because he believes in God, but because he started believing God. That is some grade A BS.
I only have a few minutes left. And I was at the
You can't make up stuff this good, Arnie.
You can't. I was at the Republican convention in 2004 in New York City, right after 9/11. So there was like, they had completely, you know, closed down the entire city. And I am at the convention, and I've told this story before. And it's really early in the morning, and I'm doing morning drive time. And who's wandering the halls at that early hour but Newt Gingrich?
Oh, yeah.
And Newt Gingrich sits down with me so he can do, because of course I'm in New Hampshire, so you want to sit with the New Hampshire talk show host because you know, you're running for something. Anyway, I looked at Newt, and I have been sort of watching the atmospherics around this convention, and I'm getting a little bit nervous. And I said to Newt, so Newt, what is this convention about? And he said, oh, it's simple, Arnie. Two words. I said, really? And what are those two words? Under God.
Right.
Under God. I sort of saw it physically because one of my friends had dragged me down to where the main floor was, and there were three podiums that were put on the main floor. And usually the podiums are metal or plastic. These were not. These were made of wood.
Of course.
And why were they made of wood? Because inside the three podiums, there was a cross.
Awesome.
Where the wood had been laid in such a way. And I am looking at this, I'm going, it's the Republican political convention. Between looking at those podiums, hearing under God and then hearing what your lieutenant governor is saying, it is such an abuse of religion, everyone. It is not about respect. It is not about separation. It is about abuse. I understand the idea of faith and how faith should infuse you.
Sure.
But it shouldn't be abused by politicians.
Well, Arnie, just remember that if the founders didn't want this to be a Christian nation, they would not have put it on our money.
I get that argument
at every one of these.
I can't wait
for the Republican Party convention in Houston, and maybe we'll get the RNC in Texas too, because North Carolina, apparently they're having a fight they can't get past
now. That's right. All right, thank you so much for joining us. If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quam Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. As Texas goes, so goes the nation. All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
Try not to get carried away on this current cast. When you think rip current, you might think the Atlantic Ocean. Rip currents are quite common in the Great Lakes as well. National Weather Service meteorologist John Hitchcock says there are a couple conditions necessary to create a rip current.
One, you need a fairly windy day that generates significant wave action. Then the second part you need is a sandy shoreline.
When the wind piles waves up on the beach, the pressure carves a trench in the sand that allows water to rush back into the lake. This happens so quickly that it carries everything out with it, including the unlucky swimmer. But don't panic. Hitchcock says you can escape from a rip current by swimming parallel to the beach. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
This is the world.
Welcome back to part deux of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and, of course, Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott, my two wonderful producers. Every other Friday, we get to hang out with Dr. Politics, a.k.a. his real name is Stefan Schmidt. He's a professor of political science at Iowa State. We have been talking about Representative Steve King for as long as I've been hanging out with you. everyone is taking the story of Steve King losing his primary as a good news story, that it is a message from Trump. Well, I don't take it that way. First of all, I think Donald Trump was smart enough not to endorse Steve King this time, although he did endorse him last time. And if you look at the RNC chosen candidate who beat Steve King, he's everything that Steve King is, but just slightly less overtly racist. I mean, I feel like I'm looking at a sort of a lighter version of Steve. So it's not a great hurrah. And the fact that Trump didn't endorse him also means that he can sort of say, oh, I support the RNC candidate because look who won. So let's talk a little bit about what happened to King and what you saw on the ground when the primary occurred.
Well, sure. Well, Steve King kind of went off the edge of the earth. He became too divisive. He sidled up to a lot of white supremacist politicians, even in Canada. Who knew that there were white supremacist politicians in Canada? But he sidled up to them, the dictatorship in Egypt, all kinds of things, questioned whether white supremacy was really a bad thing. The New York Times had an article that really drove a stake into Steve King's heart. And the National Republicans decided this was too much, and they basically kicked him off of every committee he was on and made him a pariah. So Steve King was no longer effective in any way whatsoever. The Iowa Republican establishment said, we don't want Steve King anymore, and they launched essentially a primary challenge against him. A legislator by the name of Feenstra was their favorite. And you have to understand that in that part of Iowa where Steve King is, we call it the conservative Dutch part of Iowa. There are a lot of very conservative, religious, pro-life Christians, and they are very active. And Feenstra is Dutch, you know, that's a Dutch name. So not only could they vote against Steve King for the fact that he had lost his effectiveness, but they could vote for, you know, in large numbers for a Dutch Iowan. The campaign was interesting because Steve King never campaigned. He never ran a single ad. He never did anything. At the very end, he had an op-ed piece in the Des Moines Register where he ranted about the swamp and how Feenstra was just another candidate of the Republican rhinos and the swamp in Washington, and he was being maligned and so on. And it didn't make much of a difference. And so, yes, Feenstra is very conservative. His campaign ads actually had them praying at the dinner table with his children. His main theme was that he was for life and against abortion and would completely defund Planned Parenthood. That was the gist of his campaign. So it tells you a little bit about where Iowa Republicans are, because this was a Republican primary. Now, last time, Steve King almost got defeated by the same Democrat who is running against him this time, which is J.D. Scholten, who is a lovely guy, very low-key. He was a professional baseball player and has run a kind of grassroots campaign, driving around in a big bus, hitting all the little towns and talking to people. And we'll see, you know, if he, I guess I thought that he was praying. I don't know if he prays or not, but if he was praying, he would pray that Steve King would continue to be the candidate of the Republicans, because he would have been easy to beat. Feenstra is a little bit unknown, you know. We'll see if he can veer away from the extreme conservatism that he used in the primary campaign and move a little to the center, because the district does have a place like Ames, Iowa, which is a university town. So he needs to tone down his, I think, religious conservative message a little bit.
Okay, but let's talk a little bit about the mail-in ballots, because that was the other thing that I noticed over and over again. So here the Republicans are saying, oh, you can't trust them. They're so unreliable. We don't like them. Well, let me introduce you to the fact that the guy that won in the Republican primary benefited overwhelmingly for this enormous number of mail-in ballots. So educate my listeners so they understand this, because Republicans are so interesting. It's like a selective smorgasbord. When they like it, then, oh my God, it's perfect. But in the November, it can't be trusted. It's like, come on. Inconsistency is their consistency.
Well, even more important is the fact that the governor is a Republican, the legislature is Republican in Iowa, and the Secretary of State, who manages elections, is a Republican. And the Secretary of State actually decided that mail-in ballots were really the way nowadays with the coronavirus and everything else. And he mailed out requests for mail-in ballots, absentee ballots, to every single registered voter in the state. This is a Republican. And people sent back those requests to their county and got ballots and had a tremendous, huge turnout. So, you know, and I think Scott Braddock mentioned the fact it is not a Democratic thing. And it's not a bunch of Democrats getting mail-in ballots and then filling them out, you know, getting them from old people and then filling them out and cheating and stuff. There may be a little bit of that, who knows, but overall, it seems that it is a practical and simple thing to do. And nowadays, Arnie, who wants to go to polling places? Old people go there and sit there and watch and help the voters. And older people are very vulnerable. And nowadays, they don't want to go. They can't find volunteers to go to the polling places anymore.
Well, so I've been worried, obviously, about the voting, because after Wisconsin, we started seeing an uptick. And part of the problem was twofold. A little bit what you said. You saw in Milwaukee, for example, that there was only like 8 polling places. It had shrunk by over 100 because nobody wanted to man the polling places. Right. So now you had all these people who had to show up because of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, but then you had even fewer places. So obviously there was greater density issues. But now I'm scared about something else. Initially, as I'm watching the George Floyd protests, I'm watching, obviously, very little social distancing. I'm seeing some mask wearing, but not a lot of mask wearing. But what I have also noticed is that there has been some mass arrests. And I was mentioning it to Stephanie and Dave, my two producers, before we came on the show. You don't get booked with a mask on. When they throw you in the paddy wagon, they don't let you social distance. You are now seeing these mass arrests. You're worried about the protests. You better be worried about what's happening in your cities with the mass arrest, because that is going to be a vector for the spread of COVID-19 as well. We already know that prisons are a problem to start, but now we have a whole new group of hundreds and hundreds of people in every major city in America and around the country who are being rounded up and basically being booked. And
Thousands, not hundreds, maybe tens of thousands. Here in Iowa, we've had protests every single night. And every single night, some people get arrested and taken down to the jail.
Right.
Even in Iowa.
So this is just complicating everything on so many different levels, Stefan. You have everybody rushing to open up the economy, probably somewhat prematurely. We don't have enough testing. We don't have enough tracing. Now we see what's happened with the riots. Now we see the mass arrest. It's happening across the country. It is a very sort of mixed group of people, old people, young people, white people, black people. It's truly remarkable that they're willing to run the risk. But then we've got the overreaction of the police. So much so that you saw Mattis watching that they're actually using the U.S. military against us, American citizens, and he couldn't watch it anymore. But you take a look at everything, and I feel like everything is disassembling simultaneously, and the synergistic effect is apoplectic. I mean, it's over the top.
Well, it makes for a lot of sleepless nights, that's for sure. I, you know, wake up sometimes now in the middle of the night seeing the video of the knee on the neck of the African-American in Minneapolis. I literally do, because it's such a horrible scene. The police officer looks so calm and enjoying so much grinding his knees into that neck. It is truly a daunting moment. I would say I went through the 1968 fiasco in this country with riots and demonstrations and assassinations and every kind of mayhem that you can imagine. I was a student at Columbia University. The campus was taken over, parts of it, by black students who kicked out all the white students because they didn't want white students in their particular building. white students taking over other parts. The president of the university was basically kidnapped in his office by protesting students.
I remember.
This was protests about the Vietnam War, protests about civil rights and the murder of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and all the rest of it. And when I went back and reconstructed that briefly for an article, I realized a lot of change happened after that. A lot of good change. A lot of African Americans suddenly ran for office, got elected. The number of Blacks in state legislatures, governors, in Congress went up. And there was a period of, Arnie, almost 50 years of some improvement. But now we come back to see that a lot of it was still missing. A lot of the police brutality, the way police are recruited, the way they're disciplined, which is they're not disciplined, was not reformed and wasn't changed. And so now we face the next cycle of trying to improve the way that we manage civil rights, and the way that we manage our institutions. And I can only be optimistic. I can only say, even though people will get sick and it'll affect the elections and everything else, we will come out of this at some point, and hopefully we will have learned something. And we will all together try to be better people and work harder to make things better.
We had a phenomenal interview yesterday with a professor from Brooklyn College named Alex Vitale. And Alex Vitale basically had an article both at The Guardian, at The Nation, he was interviewed all over the country, that was entitled Defund the Police. And what he was really talking about was so interesting, because in a lot of ways, what's happening because of George Floyd and the pandemic and the economy going into the crap house, is that it has exposed a lot of things. There is a problem with policing. Policing have gotten too militaristic. Too much of the of city budgets are going into the police department and not into education, are going into the police department and not into transit, are going into the police department and not into health, okay? And that, by its very nature, is kind of like the defense budget, which is like the Pac-Man of the United States budget. So as we see everything that really helps people survive in a stable and secure way is shrinking, we see the Pentagon budget exploding. And so as the Pentagon budget goes, so has the police budgets at the city level also sort of exploded. So we have to deal with just what are we doing. And his point about defunding the police is really also been highlighted by the pandemic, because the pandemic has shown the vulnerability of Americans. It has shown the vulnerability of African Americans. It's shown the vulnerability of connecting a job to healthcare. What happens when 20% of us lose our job? So all of a sudden now, it is an opportunity not to do what just Barack Obama did, which is we have to do more training with police. We have to do it, make it more kumbaya. They have to live in their neighborhood. What we have to do is understand you don't necessarily want police in your schools. You want social worker in your schools. You don't want police responding to an opioid epidemic. You want mental health counseling and addiction counseling. And that we're sending the police in to fix something that they don't have the capacity to fix.
Yeah, and the police basically are social workers, and they're not trained to do that. That's not what they, you know, the police academy teaches them how to intervene when there's, you know, some kind of an incident at a house. But it is not, you know, most of the hours every day that a police officer is working is social work.
But because they're not trained for it, because they're not rewarded for that. That's not how they're recognized, you know?
Yes.
That doesn't move you up within the police administration. And I said this yesterday, that the police unions have more in common with the NRA than they do with the police. And that's problematic. Because they are there to defend. They are, you know, this is interesting. My dad was a union organizer for the UFT, American Federation of Teachers, but in New York it was called the UFT. My father had interesting conversations with the people he organized. And that was, I am not going to cover you if you fail. I will be there if you're being mistreated by the administration. But if there's a reason for them to basically fire you, I am not going to defend you when you are wrong. I will make sure the process is fair, but I am not going to defend beating a student. I'm not going to defend. Yeah. It made him almost a pariah within the union, because they wanted to be defended right or wrong. And he said, right. That's not my job. My yeah. job is to make sure the process is fair, but not to defend wrong. And the problem with the police unions is they never got that message. They defend right or wrong, and they become intimidating, and then they intimidate the politicians, so there never is accountability.
Well, that's true. And beyond that, I mean, we suddenly have discovered that our economy is a snowflake. It's a very, very fragile economy. It's now dependent mostly on restaurants and bars and hotels and leisure travel. And that is not a robust economy. That is an economy that collapses when something like the COVID virus comes along. And so now all of a sudden, even the Republicans, Arnie, are scrambling to figure out how to rebuild the U.S. economy so that it brings more manufacturing, more real jobs, you know, that are kind of fundamental to life. Because going to a restaurant, frankly, is a lot of fun, but it's not fundamental to the survival of people. You can cook the same meal at home that you get at a nice restaurant. You may not get the atmosphere, but you still get the food. And we are going to see in the next few years a really tremendous shift in the direction that this country goes in terms of a lot of things. In Iowa right now, I just saw it this morning, a briefing. We're going to lose a huge number of our small town and rural hospitals and clinics. They are right now, they're operating in the red. Many of them are already bankrupt. And the chair of the Iowa Hospital Association, whom I know because I gave a keynote speech to their annual meeting one year, said, you know, we have no way to rescue these places because with the COVID epidemic, people are no longer coming for regular maintenance, for regular health care. And that is where they made enough money to keep those hospitals open. So we're going to see a massive collapse of the infrastructure that we need. And in Iowa, we have an aging population. So we have a lot of need for regular medical attention. It's a daunting situation that we face.
Not only is it daunting that way, but I want to talk about something other than the restaurant and the fact that it's service sector. And that is, I want to talk about the financial sector, because the financial sector also grew. And what we know about Wall Street and the financial sector is they don't make anything. They just move pots of money around. And they don't move pots of money around so that it benefits the economy. They move pots of money around so it benefits them. So the hedge fund manager can get more money. So the CEO of Goldman Sachs can get more money. So their stockholders can get more money, but not us. They don't benefit us. They bankrupt us. And I'll never forget a story that I heard where they were talking about the best and the brightest coming out of all these academic institutions. And they used to go into other sectors other than finance. And instead, all of a sudden, these brilliant minds were being seduced to go into what? To go into Wall Street, you know? And that they were being used to figure out these logarithms and all these sort of like dark money products. But that should tell you something too. There's got to be a control over the money sector, not just the service sector, because we basically encourage those manufacturing jobs to leave the United States. Right. You go into Walmart, and Walmart is everything made in China. Well, how come everything is made in China? It didn't originate that way. It started that way. So I think it's, in a lot of ways, it's a balloon, and you can't just punch in one side and not realize it's going to pop out the other side. You have to look at what happened with the financial sector. You have to look at the service industry. You have to look at the manufacturing sector. And frankly, you have to look at agribusiness. I mean, is it good that we have such huge, huge, I mean, all the pork facilities and all the beef facilities, is it good that they're so big? And then what happens with the COVID-19? Because it's not diversified and it's not spread around the country, all of a sudden, all the pork disappears because all of it had been funneled into one place.
No, that's right. I mean, we have that problem in Iowa bigger than almost any other state in the country. And when I moved to Iowa in 1970, we had a butcher here in Nevada. And if you were a hog farmer, you sent some hogs to him or cattle or chickens or whatever, and they were taken care of. And almost every town had a butcher. That all went away, and it all went to these massive international conglomerates. One of them is owned by China. One of the biggest slaughterhouses in Iowa is owned by China, so it's multinational. You have the same going on with agriculture, with the chemical companies, fertilizer companies, and others. They are now massive, and they can dictate the price and the supply. We need a Teddy Roosevelt to come along and say, geez, all these monopolies are really a bad idea. That's not capitalism. Capitalism is lots and lots and lots of people starting businesses and running them successfully. It is not a tiny number of increasingly tiny number of gigantic companies that can manipulate everything. I just saw another article. I read a lot. In the housing crisis, the 2007-08 housing crisis, a lot of people had to basically forego their house because they couldn't meet the mortgage. Those houses were all bought up by hedge funds.
I know.
They were bought up by gigantic companies that now own them and rent them. You know, the same thing is happening again right now in 2020. A lot of people who are now unemployed, those people who own restaurants or worked at restaurants and bars and cafes, they are no longer able to meet their mortgages. And they're going to foreclose, and large hedge funds and gigantic companies are buying up all those houses.
There was a graph, I have to send it to you, about the shrinking of the economy for sort of basic Americans. And then they showed the top 1 or 2% that billionaires have seen their value increase astronomically, astronomically. Sure. As we're all suffering, for whatever reason, that suffering hasn't translated up the food chain. They are growing as we are basically dissolving. And one of the things I want to remind you is, in 2007 and 2008, the reason why people lost their homes was because they were convinced to do these liar loans, that they were told that their house would be worth more next year, so don't worry about it. If you don't have the income, you can always flip it. Now, because pandemic, what we're seeing is people are unemployed and they're losing their homes. So in both situations, it was outside of their control. One was told, oh, you can lie because this is a product we're creating just for you, you know? And then after they lost their house, they bought the house just that they had sold to them. And now it's the same situation. I do think it is an incredible opportunity for us to rethink the economy, for us to sort of change our relationship with policing, change our relationship with the economy, understand that big is not necessarily better, that really, if you want to believe in capitalism, you believe in competition. Yeah. And I'm going to quote Wall Street before I let you go, Stefan. My brother works on Wall Street. My brother's one of those rich guys. And one of the things I heard from the time, you know, he got his first job at Manny Hanny, Manufacturers, Hanover Trust, was diversify your portfolio. What America failed to do was diversify our portfolio. By keep concentrating and concentrating, we did the exact opposite of what I was told historically by my friends on Wall Street. So a time for America to diversify its portfolio. Thank you so much for joining us, Stefan Schmidt. I really appreciate it.
Always my pleasure, Arnie.
All right. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arnesen. We will see you next week. And I want to thank Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott for great, great, great producing. Ciao, everyone. You've been